there, Shopomaniacs. You're listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave in the shed. Had power all week. Rupert, and with me is Chris in the booth choir. Yeah. Hey, Chris.
Well, I feel good for you. Went through some garbage times there in Austin for a minute, and that's nice. Is it 60 degrees?
Yeah, it's like 80. It's ridiculous. It went from 7 degrees to 77 degrees in like a few days. So
unprecedented. Yeah. Crazy times.
But hey, I'm in the shit. I got Ethernet wired up now. So I'm cooking at 800 megabits up and down. It feels pretty good. So latency solved for the rest of my adult life, hopefully.
You asked me like 10 years, 20 years ago, probably even less, like, are we still going to be wiring up our internet? I'd be like, no way. We're going to definitely Wi-Fi will beat Ethernet.
Yeah. However, no. Unless you can physically see the router, you're in danger. That's what I've learned in my adult life. Unless you could see that thing, you're in danger of losing signal and sounding stupid on a call.
So. Yeah, there should be like a sign like they have on semi trucks on the highway, you know, like if you can't see his mirrors, he can't see you.
Yeah.
I guess that's slightly sexist, but you got to pick one or the other. Okay, so we're going to talk, you know, we've been talking about JavaScript in 2021.
Yeah.
Just it feels like in the water anyway, but I like it. I think it's been fun.
Yeah, you know? I think every day I realize, oh, I was doing things the 2 years ago way, and that's so obsolete, you know? I feel like even now it's still changing under my feet. So,
yeah, totally. There's like literal differences, you know, than a couple of years ago. Which is cool.
Yeah, I think that, you know, kind of recapping so far, you know, I think the big thing is no IE, right? Or like no. And so that takes off a lot of polyfilling. That takes up a lot of, you know, bundling and packing and even just like how you import things.
Right.
Like it's less of a deal, right? Like, and maybe.
Yeah, it's causing some big reevaluations. Like, do I even really need Babel on this thing? Or people are like, well, yeah, I do, of course, because that's the thing that does my JSX. So then they're like, well, that's weird. Maybe we should just process that some other way then if we're done. Or maybe we'll do the thing where we make the two packages, the old package and the new package, and all that. These conversations are happening. But if you know, are fortunate enough to work on a very modern project, you might not need nothing at all. You might be just rocking and rolling Rust, you know, and everybody I talk to is feeling that in some way, that it's not just, it's no IE, but plus like ES6 plus.
Yeah. Yeah. The language evolution has been pretty good. So there's a lot of features, I think modules has to be the hugest thing, right? Like, there's,
if not async await.
Async await. I'm using that all the time now, you know? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, tremendous. The language evolves in ways that's not just like, that's a little syntactic sugar. It's like, it kind of felt that way at first, and now it's like, oops, accidentally that transformed the whole landscape. So, wow. But there's all these little bits and pieces. And so a couple episodes ago, we had the, Fred and Jason on from Snowpack, Skypack, Preact, WMR, respectively, kind of thing, to talk next gen bundlers. So I didn't want to, and that's what I called them. And then I did a little tweet storm. I was like, to solidify my thoughts and like, what's a variety of things that you might put under the umbrella of JavaScript in 2021? And the first one in that thread was, I called them the next gen bundlers are here. And then I was like, I wonder if that was a wrong way to classify these things or what? So let's explore a little bit. Webpack is a bundler. They say the word bundle on the homepage.
Yeah, yeah.
Rollup and Parcel also do. Even ESBuild, everybody's fancy boy these days, calls itself a bundler. So that's interesting. That's four things that like literally refer to themselves as bundlers. And I know they're all very different in a way, you know, but not quite prepared to talk about all the little differences there. But then I was like, what I think of as next gen bundlers are like the two that we talked about from that show, Snowpack and WMR, and then Vite, I believe is the correct way to say it now. If you go to that homepage of Vite, it says it's for the French word fast or something, and then you press the, I put it into the Google Translate and had them pronounce it, and it said vite.
Okay.
So I believe that's correct, although on the homepage it says it's pronounced V-I-T, which to me very much is vit.
Yeah, yeah.
And in my head forever, it was vite. Uh-huh. So all those are wrong. It's vite.
So vite like yeet. Like, I'm just going to yeet this code. I'm going to vite this code. Just
yeet. I think of Veep the show, but sure, yeah.
Veep. Okay, okay.
Veep. Whatever. Vite. Okay. Snowpack calls itself a build tool. WMR calls itself a development tool. And Vite calls itself front-end tooling. So tool is the word of these new ones, not so much bundler.
Okay.
So interesting. Interesting. I don't know what to think of all that, but I just thought that it was interesting that that has evolved too, like the name of these things, even though some of the jobs they do are different. And it got me thinking about jobs they do. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the jobs they do of tools like this? Because that's part of the opinionated stack of what these things choose to do and choose not to do. And it's so fascinating what we like have come to like ask and expect of a tool like this or a bundler or whatever. So the word bundle, right? I'm going to go through them all really quick and then we'll back up and maybe I missed some and then we'll go into them. So they combine stuff, mm-hmm. they do the bundling, and that might mean your code, but it also means stuff from NPM. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the trust on these things is like, please prepare all this code that I'm authoring for production. I need something that does all the work, that produces files that I know I can trust in production. That's kind of what we're asking from a bundler.
Small files, not broken. Like smaller files.
Yeah. Yeah. Broken. Do a good job. Not broken
minified,
is huge.
I and, guess, not small. Yeah. They're never small, but. Minified.
No. But yeah, even minification is interesting because that's part of preparing a file for production, right? And so it would be like a source map. Like, I expect that out of these tools. Like, that's what I need to ship to production, so please make it for me.
Tree shaking?
In the case of a source map, maybe you
might be in there.
Tree shaking is interesting because that's the one that removes dead code.
I don't want all of Lodash. I just want whatever.
Right. And who knows? I have no... Lodash is the perfect example because it's intended to be tree shaken in a way. But I don't know like how much of React gets tree shaken out when you write it. I have no idea, but some or none. I don't know. But and then think of the 500 other libraries that your project probably uses. There's probably quite a bit of that going on. Then there's the fact that you have this tool and you're writing code in it that's intended for production, but it's also your development tool. You're also asking of this thing, as I write code, you're running too. You're my partner in creating this website. You should be the web server. That's become an expectation that your bundler is also your web server. Very weird, but that's often the case.
So do you associate that with the old stuff or is that kind of in the new stuff? Like,
I don't know. I think it's both.
I kind of put it
like
in
it would
the
be weird
stuff,
to be a bundler.
You like, do? Cause I don't know. Webpack, I suppose you could install the right plugin or whatever, but I don't think of it as spinning up my local node server.
It totally
I thought
does.
It just spun up its own. Like that's what it is in my brain. It's,
oh yeah. It spins up its own. Yeah. I guess that's what I mean.
It's like, I have to open a new terminal tab and type webpack, blah, blah. And it'll just start crunching that file, like.
Right, but you don't also use that.
I don't type
like localhost, you know, 111 or something. You haven't taught Webpack to be that server, yeah? Because the problem is you use it like something like Nuxt might use Webpack under the hood. I don't know if it.
Yeah,
does
I think
or not.
Nuxt
it probably uses Rollup.
You know, Gatsby is kind of just a glorified Webpack.
But
they
have their own. Server or something in it. So you think of that thing as the thing that's providing the server, but under the hood, it's probably whatever the bundler is.
Okay. Well, all right.
But it depends. I mean, I use Webpack in the context of Rails, and I don't. Webpack server is running, crunching files, but it's Rails that's being the web server.
Yeah.
So you need something to be the web server, and you kind of want it to be because. If it's the web server, then it can do other intelligent stuff like hot module reloading. If something else was the web server, it wouldn't know like when to do that and when to refresh and when to inject new code and stuff. You kind of want it involved with being the web server locally. I don't know that anybody uses like the Webpack server on production serve the thing.
Please don't.
Probably not. But you want that to be fast too. But so now you're trusting it you're trusting this bundler for your production. That's why you're using it in the first place, but it's also become your development experience too. So you're trusting on both sides of that equation. Mm-hmm. So tree shaking. Then because it's your dev server and it's, you know, where all this processing is happening of JavaScript, because largely we're talking about JavaScript, people are like, it should do everything. Like if I'm going to write in SaaS, whatever my bundler is, I don't want to like be totally on my own to figure out how to process my SAS or my TypeScript or my CSS modules or my JSX or whatever too. I should be able to teach this bundler about anything I want to process. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Anything. So that should be like part of the game too. And then, so we have ESM or even like fake ESM for node modules and stuff, but there is no like good, you can't like import a CSS file into a JavaScript file, even though every Webpack tutorial you look at will do that. Yeah. That's like a fake invented thing that bundlers do. Now bundlers kind of, they're like, okay, well that's your job too. You should be able to deal with images. You should be able to deal with SVG if you need to. You should be able to deal with CSS. That's kind of an expectation of a bundler too. So holy crap, that list of stuff that it's doing is a big deal. Not to mention that it has to like finger its way through your files to do this work. It's yeah. also like an AST thing mm-hmm. or whatever. It's got to like, it's got to figure out how to do all this work. So the jobs that it have are a lot, but that's not to say that every tool needs to do all these things. And that's kind of what's changing, I think, is that not all of them do that. For example, the minification, for example, like Webpack can do that and often does, but you'll look at a configuration, it'll be like, oh, it's using the Terser Webpack plugin. Well, Terser isn't Webpack. They're like, that's not the same team. Mm-hmm. Terser is its own thing. So it's decided, you know, it's bundled all together. You'll often see them together, just like you might see Tailwind and Purge CSS together, but they're not the same. They're not the same project. They just happen to use each other.
Yeah, they're siblings. And then Terser uses whatever hooks Webpack provides to just run at the right time. So,
yeah. And then you look at like WMR, right? It has this list of opinionated stuff it does. One of them is not tree shaking. I don't know if it does tree shaking or if that's just implied or what, but you don't see that word anywhere on the document. So then you're like, did it just punt on it or does that not matter anymore or what?
Yeah. Like, you know, and I wonder, I assume it does in the build process. It says a highly optimized rollup build production, like, so it uses rollup to
rollup does the tree shaking.
It uses rollup to build it behind the scenes, but that's where these things get weird. It's just like a server, but then I guess I could skip ahead. I don't know. I was using Vite yesterday, last night, and I'm writing view files just in a directory, and I'm typing Vite serve or whatever or npm run.
Okay, so it's got a web server.
It's got a web server, but it's like...
Does hot modular reloading, sure.
Hot modular reloading, and it's really fast. Like, it's because of the ES build is all built into there, right? But like, and that's using ES build. I didn't realize like other stuff was slow, but I'm realizing, oh, this is very fast. And same, I think, with WMR. It's like, oh, this is actually fast. Like, but what I think these tools are kind of doing is they're like kind of doing on-the-fly translations. Like it knows about it says, oh, okay, they're authoring in some kind of file that I need to watch, and then I'll transpile it, and then I'll hot module reload. It's interesting. Yeah. It's like even back to like that whole quintessential example, like import foo from foo is not JavaScript. That's Node. You know, that's not ES imports, you know?
Yeah.
So they're,
and I wonder if Vite is doing this too, but I know that Snowpack and WMR are like, okay, you've imported Vue. I'm not going to do that again.
Right.
I've already done this once.
I've done this, so.
Webpack will not. It's going to pull that again, and it's going to combine it all together, and it's going to do whatever it needs to do every time you hit Command S. And I think that's kind of a core innovation of these other tools, is that it's like, oh, no, I already have that copy. I've already done what I'm going to do for that. Yeah. Maybe in production, I'll bundle it all together. But while we're here in dev, I'm not going to do that. I've already done it.
Only changing the ones we already were using, you know? Like, mm-hmm. there on the page. So I'm kind of seeing them more as these like on the fly translation layers. I don't know if you read Hitchhiker's Guide, but like the Babelfish, you know, it's for sure. me, it's like a Babelfish. And it's just like, you write however you want, and these things figure out how to do it as fast as possible, make it into something you can see, which is different, right? Like, it's slightly different than like, give me all your files, and then I'm going to crunch them through my big Rube Goldberg machine. You know, this is more like, what are you working on, buddy? Cool. Let me, I'll just fix that for you and shove it over the browser. Okay, great. What's the next thing? You know, it's a different world. So I don't know.
This episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you by AxeCon 2021, a free digital online, of course, accessibility conference.
From our friends at DeQ, the makers of the popular Axe browser extension, comes an open and inclusive digital accessibility conference welcoming developers, designers, business leaders, and professionals of all levels to a unique event focused on building, testing, and maintaining accessible digital experiences.
Yeah, that's a lot, but it's pretty sweet. I've been using the Axe browser extension a lot, and it's tremendous in what it can do. So AxeCon, the conference, has amazing speakers like Vint Cerf, widely known as the father of the internet, Rachel Andrew, known as the mother of the internet. Just kidding, but to me, she is. Noted web developer and former editor at Smashing Magazine, Rachel is. Val Head, speaker, author, design advocate at Adobe, Sarah Swaydan, renowned speaker and UI engineer. Maybe other than Vint, I think all those people have been on the show, right?
Oh, yeah.
And who else is going to be there?
It's your boy. I'm going to be talking about like backlogs and how like we can turn a accessibility backlog into actual accessibility stuff. But there's so many other amazing people. I'm going to call out Angela Hooker, who I work with from time to time at Microsoft. She's really amazing. I've listened to her talk about alt tags for like an hour, and it was just inspiring. Dennis Boudreaux over at DeQ, amazing accessibility person, very involved. Jamie Knight and Lyon. Jamie works at BBC, but is like brings like a neurodiversity perspective to things. There's so many good people. Elle Waters, been on the show, I believe. Eric Bailey, who's helps like basically does the accessibility project. So Eric is just top-notch folks. So there's so many other people. Like I'm just scrolling through the site. You want to go, they have a whole dedicated developer track. It's for us. It's for people like us.
Yeah, right. And by a company that obviously like has all their chips in the game here. So I'd love to see what they have to say too. You know, like they're the perfect people to be throwing this conference. So that's pretty excited. Pretty exciting, I should say. Yeah, like I don't know. I'm just stoked. I want to be there for years, though. You know, turning it into actionable stuff, and the plugin helps with that. So yeah, because it's like, here's an issue. I've taken this guided tour. You should tell me what I should do. You know.
Well, yeah. So I was gonna say, sorry, this is turning into a whole segment. But Segun Ola is going to talk about like integrating stuff into your dev tools. That's like, if I understand just talk title and stuff correct, abstract correctly, but it's like there's going to be good stuff. Like, how do you bring this stuff into your dev tooling process? So there you go.
That's the number one thing I care about. When are we doing this?
Okay, so join us March 10th, 11th for this conference. Register for free at deq.com/axe-con. One last time, that's deq.com/axe-con.
I'm sorry, this is free? Okay.
Free. It's too good. Accessibility is that important.
A little too good.
You should show up. Can't wait to see you there. Hopefully, come to my talk.
Okay. We'll see you there. Bye-bye. Well, so now I covered all the expectations, and you say you're using Beat for a little thing.
Yeah.
Vite. Okay. Does it combine files? Yes. Probably.
Yes. Here, I could tell you what it does exactly, but there's also a build step. And so that build step produces like little hashed files, you know, and, you know.
Okay. So you've is this probably a different story for dev and production or not? Or is it just like, man, we're so fast, I'm just going to do the same.
Different story for dev and production. And then
there is. Okay.
And then like, let's see, run dev. I'm going to start.
So it supports pulling stuff from NPM and doing whatever it's going to do and combining your code too. It's funny that we refer to it as third party code and first party code. What is second party code?
I don't know.
Has anybody ever talked about it?
Okay. Your best friend. It's your best. Or
yeah. Your colleagues.
When somebody's talking about your code, I don't know. So like, yeah, it's really confusing. Like, I'll just say it's confusing because it like, you know, again, browsers, and this is another thing where everything gets kind of mixed up for me. Browsers do a really good job because it hands it a source map. And so when I look in my browser, guess what I see? I just see like view files because my browser tooling is now like intercepting.
Yeah, that's incredible. So if you have a problem on line 7, even your browser is going to tell you in your view file, which it is definitely not interpreting itself. Mm-hmm. The problem is on line 7.
Yeah.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
like,
that's incredible.
Yeah. And so like I'm writing a view file and it says like, okay, cool. Here's your view file. Like, it's just kind of, it's different, you know, like, and I wish I like, so
that's another thing we'll throw on the pile is this like error handling experience, you know, we want that. We're asking that from our tooling.
You know, I think a lot, I think browser tools factor into this as well. Like you can do, you know, you can read the source a lot easier, and that's just a different, I don't know, that's a mm-hmm. different world. But like, so I have, I'm trying, let me see how many JavaScript files come through. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 different JavaScript files. Maybe there's one plug in there. You know, but it's like 2 view files, 3 view files, 4 view files. And I think that's like hot modularly reloading or something like that. So,
okay.
But you know, it's not like this intense load here that I'm seeing. So, I mean,
does it do the NPM thing? Pull stuff third party? Yes.
Yes.
All right. Cause it's built for Vue and all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Does it do TypeScript?
Yes, it would.
Right? So it does other processing too. It doesn't say anything about SAS, it looks like, but it will do CSS modules and it will do that special kind of importing of raw vanilla CSS into JavaScript files, which is so bizarre to me. I never got into that, but that's
a yeah, thing. I think Vite uses plugins kind of in the spirit of like
rollup or
whatever. Yeah, or just like, hey, you're using JSX, use the JSX plugin or I think they actually maybe require you to append .jsx to your files instead of JS just mm-hmm. because they can okay. efficiently hand that off to the JSX transpiler.
So it's doing that thing where if you need to, whatever you need to process, it will help you process it.
Right.
It makes optimized builds. So of course it's doing minification and stuff. Certainly like all the rest of these, it reaches out to some third party tool to do that. It probably is not its own minifier, but okay. I have no idea about the tree shaking. I never hear that word anymore. Like, does it do that or not do that? And then there's this thing that you always heard in conjunction with tree shaking, which was code splitting, because when you code split, you know, it might be a file on your about page that needs some code that your homepage doesn't. So it will tree shake out the things that aren't used at the one route to another. That seems like a big deal. Like that was talked about a lot, was this like, I'm going to make two different bundles, one for this area of the site and one for this other area of the site. And not only that, but this bundler is going to assume that you're might be building some kind of single page app so that when you navigate to that other page, it's going to load that additional bundle. Now, what's loading that additional bundle? Some network request surely must happen, right? So your bundles have in it like fetch code. Mm-hmm. They can do that. Who wrote that? You didn't. Some plugin didn't. Your bundler wrote it.
Yeah.
Webpack or whatever injected some special fetch code stuff in it that does that, which is fascinating to me. But that's like a thing that it's doing for you that's like on this pile, huge haystack of crap that front-end tooling does
for you. Yeah, like some kind of dynamic import structure tree. And I know they're trying to like standardize that, maybe like import maps, you know, like, or that's still a little different. That's like where like you have like named imports or something like that. So,
that's interesting though, isn't it? Like, I wonder if these tools can get dumber because the language gets smarter. For example, I know that was kind of the core innovation perhaps of Webpack, was that it's spidering through your code base to find all the crap that it needs to import is tricky business, and it could do all that and cool, right? So you don't have to teach it every last file you want to be combined and all that. I mean, think of a grunt build or whatever. You had to be like, put jQuery and combine it with my index.js file and squish it together. You had to be really like explicit that you wanted that to happen.
These in this order.
These two.
Like,
yeah. And with Webpack, it was like, I don't know, just spider through my site and figure out what you need to do. And that's how all of them work these days. Mm-hmm. You know, literally everything does that. It's just, it looks at your code and it figures out what it needs to do from your code rather than configuration. Well, that's not so amazing anymore. If you just say, well, do that, but only do that with language features, like do it with ESM, do it with native CSS imports, whatever, only do what the language itself supports. Don't try to be fancy on top of that. I don't think we're there yet. Looks like even Vite, as fancy and new as it is, says, oh, we support these kind of like non-standard import things because we know you want them. And so we're going to do that. So it has to have some fancy stuff built in, but it looks like it's pretty opinionated about what it supports.
Yeah. That's like, maybe we can get somebody on here to talk about that, but that's sort of like the, like JSX is not part of the platform, but then people are like, well, we better support JSX. Like, everyone's using it, so we got to do that, you know, like, and it's just interesting. Like, something gets popular enough. It's not a standard by any means. I mean, But then it just, the concern becomes big enough that any new tool that shows up has to support this, the old, you know,
right.
Too big to fail kind of vibes, right?
That's like kind of like hot modular reloading is like that. It just has to have that. I don't know what's required to make that work, but nobody's going to work with a new bundler that doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. That would be nuts.
A step backwards.
You need to have that fast experience, and it needs to have great error handling, so I know exactly what's going on and where, and hopefully it looks beautiful in my browser when things error and I can see what file it's on and blah blah blah.
That said, I traded MacRabbit the CSS, what styles, what is the app, the old MacRabbit app where you just like code styles in your app.
It's just called CSS something, wasn't it? See, it had the word CSS in the title. What was that? That's funny. That was hot. Yeah, people really liked that.
There was
that.
Espresso, but...
And then CodePen came along and be like, we
do that now. Oh my gosh. CSS Edit is
maybe
what
it was Espresso.
CSS
Edit. Oh, CSS Edit. I knew it had CSS in the name.
Espresso was the code editor. But, you know, it was like this dedicated CSS authoring app back in the early 2000s or something. And you would just like type your CSS. It would hot reload it, like live reload it on the page inside this little window and like spit out a whole new web page. You could just like author CSS really, really fast. But then SAS came along and it didn't support SAS, of course, you know. But I was like, but right. I want those variables. So I did trade for something slower, not as good, and didn't live reload. Eventually I got those features, but you know, I did trade it for.
Yeah. Very good point.
But I would also go back to MacRabbit if it existed because that was hella cool. I don't know, man. It was so good. It just such a beautiful.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. You can even buy Espresso still, which has some of those features in it.
Oh yeah.
It looks like Webflow, you know, like a Mac OS Webflow where you like click text and you're like, oh, well, here's like UI to change the text to small caps. It's a button and you press it.
Yeah. Heck yeah.
You know, just different ball game. Anyway, I thought I'd talked about. So back to Vite for 1 second. Does it do tree shaking and code splitting? I have no idea. We'll get Evan on to talk about that. But, you know, maybe. But it certainly has a web server. It certainly does hot modular reloading. You know, it certainly handles other kinds of imports. It has a plugin system. It's new, so that will probably evolve over time. But then it has this thing, you know, you can still trust it. It's still saying we'll produce great production code for you out of it. Don't worry about that. And we got you on the flip side too. It's super fast and the DX of it is super good. So we kind of do ask a lot of these tools. Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very interesting. And so, you know, what happens in this, you can almost predict the next generation beyond this, because you look at this list and the list doesn't actually change that much. It's just like, what are we going to break off because we don't need to do it anymore? What are we going to trust some other tool to do? You know, what are we, it's like we need less because the language evolves, or like our developer tastes evolve or whatever. Like maybe we won't need a dev server anymore because browsers are just like, I don't know, just point at your index.html file and use ES modules for everything, and we'll be really fast at refreshing. Maybe command R gets so fast in browsers that you don't need hot module reloading or a dev server at all.
Yeah, there's something to be said. Like hot module reloading is very nice when your bundle is 1 megabyte of JavaScript. But when it's like 8K or 4K or something, refreshing is usually just fine. I mean, but yeah, if more features come, maybe bundles get smaller. Maybe, I don't know.
Oh, no, maybe you don't have to bundle at all. You know, that's starting to be part of the story, too. Yeah. So, yeah, minification matters less because, you know, browsers, you know, like you put your site in cloud front of Cloudflare and maybe you just start trusting the CDN layer mm-hmm. to handle all your minification, all that stuff. Why does it have to be a part of a build process if your site's in front, if Cloudflare is in front of it anyway?
Right.
Well, this episode of Shop Talk Show is brought to you in part by WooCommerce. WooCommerce is e-commerce plugin for WordPress. So you install it on your, you know, your self-hosted WordPress site and you got e-commerce going. It's the e-commerce that powers the e-commerce behind WordPress.com and such as well. It is a hugely battle-tested software. You know, the statistics for WordPress are wild. You know, it's like powers like over a third of the internet, which is a hard thing to wrap your mind around, at least for me. But the statistics behind WooCommerce are similar. It's super dominant in the e-commerce space. So you know this is big time software that you can trust. It comes from the Automattic team itself, just like WordPress.com. And they, you know, they have a ton of developers behind WordPress itself and all that. It's free. Like, you know, WordPress is itself. It's open source. You can just use it. You can do most anything you'd want to do with WooCommerce for free. Its business model, though, is that WooCommerce themselves make tons of plugins that are paid that extend the functionality to it to do advanced things that you'd want to do. So, for example, let's say you make something and you sell it. You can pull that off on WooCommerce using free stuff. You know, they even have a shipping plugin that's an add-on for WooCommerce. That's free. That allows you to print out shipping labels and all that. But let's say you're like running a fairly complicated shipping situation. You know, they're like, I need to add weights for all my product. And then this like combination of products exceeds this level of weight. It needs to have this, you know, price associated with it, but it's discounted if they go over this thing. And then it costs more if it's in this particular distance away from where I'm shipping it, all that. Very complicated stuff. They have a plugin called Table Rate Shipping. It handles all that. And it's not some third-party thing that who knows if they're going to keep up, whatever. It comes from WooCommerce themselves. It's called Table Rate Shipping. It costs $99 a year. And if you're at the level of business where that's what's going on with your shipping situation, $100, I'm sure, is very much within the cost of doing business for you, I hope. You know, I had a product one time, or I was, you know, selling through a company, and the company like didn't care about the fact that I was using WooCommerce or WordPress or anything, but they're just like, I don't know, we ship our stuff with ShipStation. That's like the industry standard for what they're doing. There's a plugin by WooCommerce for ShipStation. And so like they didn't care how I like sold these t-shirts, but the fact is that the order went to ShipStation meant that they could fulfill it and everything was honky-dory. They didn't care about my side. They just cared that it worked with ShipStation. And that's been true a number of times for me. So WooCommerce, great software. I just wanted to, you know, tell you about it a little bit. Thanks for the support. Anyway, very interesting stuff. JavaScript in 2021. Just kind of wanted to think that through a bunch more. I should ask you about your personal experience a bit more. Is it, Veet, you know, are you feeling it?
I like it. Yeah. So I mean,
you feel productive.
I bit off two things, right? Two pieces of technology. Veet, because I just was like, whatever, we're in the Discord. Discord's chatting it up. Plug the Discord here. Ka-ching, ka-ching.
That's our Patreon, and it's going awesomely, and I love everybody in there.
It's awesome. Fun.
Join us.
Lots of talk about your hands hurting. So if you're into that, different build tools and stuff. Anyway, I was going to say, but people were talking about bundlers and stuff like that in there. And, yeah. And I just was like, oh, I'm going to just have something to use Veet on, and basically I can spoil it. I don't even know if I'm ever going to release this, but it's called RSS Tester. That's what I'm calling it now. But it's basically just a little app where you can like put an RSS feed in and get it like view it in a fake RSS reader. So it's just this idea of like, oh, what's my RSS feed look like? Is it just trashed or like what, you know, or just kind of a quick way to like spot check this. I might not release it. I'm having fun with it. I'm going to keep it. I'll probably keep building future features. I might not release it because like it dangerously sets HTML or whatever, you know.
How does how are you parsing the XML?
jQuery. So here's something I learned. You know, Cores Anywhere, are everybody's favorite website, you know?
Yeah.
That doesn't work anymore.
75% of the time. Yeah. Ooh, it's down to 0%.
0% of the time because they capped everything. They basically like cut it out of, they turned off every, like they basically turned on Cores, I guess. So it's so like,
that's too bad. So what'd you do? Write a little Netlify.
Now I have a function and I'm running this little node app called RSS parser, which turns an XML feed into JSON back. And so it's,
what?
Yeah, so it's pretty cool.
What does that? Well, so then can you trust it, really? Is it this, like, what if something happens in that conversion process that makes your feed look safe, but really it's not?
I don't know.
sorry. This is not
I haven't gotten that far, Chris.
We weren't asking.
And that's why I'll probably never release it, you know, because immediately somebody's going to be like, I wrote a blog post that had a XML injection, you know, or whatever script injection, and your site rendered the script injection. And so it's like, well, cool, you got me, man. I don't know. I'm gonna, you know, there's new browser stuff coming out, like the sanitize API. Have you seen that? Like there's features for like sanitizing HTML and content and stuff like that. So I could, in theory, sanitize this stuff maybe easier. And just make sure that nothing, I don't know, even that though, you turn on the sanitizer and then it breaks Unicode. You know what I mean? So it's just a bummer. So,
yeah, I mean, I had to write some sanitization code this week. So there you have it. You know, I used a gem that was good and did most of what I wanted, but it did too much and too little.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those things where it stripped some crap it shouldn't and didn't strip some other stuff that it should. And I was like, oh my God.
Yeah. Now all angle brackets come out as ampersand GT colon.
Yeah. You know? That, even that, I would have been like, fine. But yeah, actually, that would have been just as obnoxious. I had a thought though. Oh, I had to write, I still have some production code on CSS Tricks that pulls the feed, that literally the XML. Then I run it through an XML parser thing. What was one of those called? It's like PHP powered jQuery, essentially, where you can like load the DOM in PHP and execute selectors on it and transform it.
Very cool. Yeah.
Very cool. It's built into WordPress. So if you need like an HTML, XML-y jQuery thing, you can just, it's there for you to use. I don't know how they use it internally, but that's not terribly surprising. You know, all their hooks transform code and stuff. So it loads that thing up because when you inject an image in WordPress, it puts the width and height attributes on images. And often I'll just upload just enormous images, you know, just 5,000 pixels wide or whatever, because I don't even care, because it's going to make smaller versions of them on the fly. And then even those go through a CDN to resize them and stuff. I don't care what the original is. The original should be enormous. Mm-hmm. But if my image is 5,000 pixels wide, the attributes on the image will say width equals 5,000, height equals, you know, 22,800, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then I had that go into a feed. So that's what is output in the XML of the RSS feed. And then I would point it at MailChimp and say, send this as a newsletter. And it would grab that image and it would, whatever transforms it did on it, would just put it in the email at 5,000 pixels wide. And it was like, not a good scene, man.
Yeah.
You know, like that doesn't do good stuff.
I know from experience, that is just absolutely wrecking the Windows mail client. So
I just have this little XML parser that just finds those. And it just for this feed that's intended just for MailChimp, which otherwise does the right thing, I like strip those attributes and put in the medium-sized image or put in an image that's resized to be like 500 pixels wide or something. Mm-hmm. It's like perfect for email or something, but not if it's too small and whatever. It's just a little bit of custom code. But that makes its way into an XML file. So it's on me to sometimes test that XML file and look at what the output of it. So I would open it up in your tool and be like, cool, looks good.
Yeah. Does it show like a blog post-y kind of thing?
Did I miss a closing angle bracket? Because if it does, it's toast.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's kind of it. I mean, you know, I do silly RSS tricks and stuff like that. That's my new blog, RSS-tricks. And then, but like, you know, I just was like, you know, it would be cool to see what happens. One issue I'm running into is I use like absolute URLs, like image source equals slash, you know, image.jpg, and yeah. my thing doesn't do it, but you know, a feed bin or something will, like it has knowledge of like a base name, you know.
No, it fixes your crap.
So it'll
for
fix
you?
The URL. That's nice. So that's interesting too, right? Like,
that is interesting. Is it consistently work in RSS readers, or does it just happen to work in feed bin? Because
I think it consistently works in RSS readers. Like they've negotiated the route or something.
I like that. That's good.
But again, that would be something to know, you know, do I need to use absolute URLs? But what's weird is when it goes to my personal site, now that's in a CloudFront because like Netlify has taken it and did a process on it too, you know? So
yeah, they are right. Oh, interesting.
Yeah. It's wild how you can like computers. Author something, spit out a static site, upload that static site, and then changes happen. Then just even like your XML
right.
for your feed gets changed. Your
Right.
I don't know.
Then your workers get involved and you're like, you know, you have this whole other layer of control way after you've built and deployed the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It can still be manipulated in a way. You know what? I fixed a bug. Well, we had one on CodePen for a minute where Cloudflare was in front of even the output code in a pen, you know, the little preview area, and it injected this little script in there that was, you know, Cloudflare has a bunch of these that, like, for example, optimizes images for mobile or something. I have no idea how it works, but it just does some kind of magic to make that experience better. But that should not probably be in your output on CodePen, mm-hmm. because then it's a child of the body. And who knows what people do on CodePen? They can target body last child and have it do something important for their layout or something. And now it's not going to target this thing that they think it's going to target. It's going to target this script instead because it's been injected there.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you have to stop it from doing that. But that's the kind of example of something that you're like, I can't test this in dev. I can't even write a test for it because the test will pass. It only happens in production, and it's the worst kind of bug. You know?
Those are the worst, and that's what you get. That's why you never bundle your code, kids. Never.
I know. Just do that. Don't even use HTTPS. Do you see? I saw Remy Sharp was going.
Oh, really?
On Twitter the other day that
he's got some old man energy going right now. So I'll.
It may be that. Sorry, Remy, a little bit, you know, because it's not like he was like arguing that HTTPS is bad. It's just that if you really fundamentally look at it, it is technically a barrier in some situations, because some super old browsers cannot parse the crypto that HTTPS is today. You know, it's like a small one, but it's just like, you know, grid layout doesn't work in all browsers, but that doesn't break the entire website, you know, and we still talk about like, well, we should, you know, we should write at supports rules to support these kind of things. We're like, there is no at supports rule for HTTPS, you know, yeah. It can be the ultimate shutdown, you know, if we're going to have conversations about what if a site works with and without JavaScript, then maybe it should work with and without HTTPS also. Or should it?
Okay.
You know, and that will get people fired up.
Okay. You know? Whoa. Twist. All right. Yeah. I mean, because, you know, TLS, like, is kind of, I think, the underlying technology, right? Like how they sign the certificates or whatever. And, you know, 1.1 is super hackable. I think we're on 1.3 or 4 now or something like that. So, but like, you know, so like, if I, my, whatever SSL is in or servers TLS 1.3, you know, a browser
is like, if you use Let's Encrypt, it probably is.
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully it's the most secure version I can get. Like then an older browser will just be like, dude, I don't speak this. I don't know what this crypto is, you know? So,
well, I think we're at the point where like IE6, which we used to all joke about and now nobody ever mentions ever, but it was a thing for a very long time. I think we're at the point where if you like loaded up a Netlify site or something, not that this is Netlify's fault, it's just they're just grab a Let's Encrypt and certificate.
Yeah.
It would just not load in IE6. Just would just not, it would just get nothing.
For Netlify, they're protecting, it's a twist, right? Like you're protecting users with the best security available. It's like I installed airbags into this car. Why do you not like it? You know, it's like, well, I drive an old car and we don't have airbags, you know?
I'm the worst person to ask. I'll be like, I completely don't care. I don't care about Isaac. I don't even care if your site works, if it requires JavaScript to work. I was,
where do you start caring? Tell me what version of mobile Safari you stop caring about. 10?
I hate to admit this, but some days my careometer is real low.
That's fair.
It's like, this is a business. I'm trying to survive here. I think this is a fun question from Matthew Krelling here. I have kind of saved up. Switching back to a stale tab, meaning, you know, it's a tab you haven't seen in a couple of days. Back there.
Ooh, hey.
Ooh. Chrome and Firefox seem to basically reload the website in those browsers. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen that? You go back to the tab and it's just like, it was gone. Like the tab was there, but it hadn't even tried to load that page. Right. I am too lazy to provide more of a background, although I did push Matthew on it and he made a video for me. So you're not that lazy, Matthew. Was touted as a way to reduce load on your computer's CPU/memory. Does this suck or not? Discuss. And his little video here is just what you'd expect it as he tabs back to a page that looks like it's ready to go, you know, but it's not, you know, it's like a GitHub repo or something. And you can see its spin. You can see the spinner in the tab. You can see the page do a white flash and it loads, you know.
It kind of just restarts, re-hiccups.
Do you have an expectation that if a tab is open, that there's something there, that it has loaded that stuff? Or do you like it that the browser has decided to not do that?
So you can either accept this new, where tabs sleep, that's a new feature in Edge and Chrome, but like these sleeping tabs, it'll put tabs to sleep, like basically decommission the tab. You still have access to it. You can go back to it, but it goes to sleep. And that may affect timers, like set timeout and stuff like that will basically crash, you know? And that's maybe what's happening on these things, but then, so you can either like accept that browsers do this, put tabs to sleep, or you have to give up your Chrome hogs too much memory jokes or whatever. So this is just how browsers are going to manage memory. Like they every web page takes a certain amount of memory to load and render and stuff like that. Every little tab takes memory to render. And if you don't want your fans to spin up just using Chrome, you need, like, they have to do something to unload this memory. So I think it's a net win. Like, it's weird. And there's ways to work around that, those like set timeout things. Like you can use, window Window Visibility API. Blah. That was a mouthful. But basically, you just have to like, you can stash stuff in like local storage and stuff like that too. But maybe your timer only runs, or when the Window Visibility API changes, you then reset your countdown timer or something like that. You know, so that's a feature you can use.
Yeah, I've seen it. I was on somebody's web, Stefan something is on their page. I had their tab open for a bunch of days, and every time I came back to it, there was a screensaver on it of a little thing bouncing around. Okay. They implemented a, you know, this page is idle, so I'm going to put a full page overlay on it and animate it. I don't know if that's less memory or more, but hey.
Well, I wonder how they're doing that, you know? Like, I wonder if there's a way to detect whether a page is idle or will be.
Right. There's probably good and bad ways.
Yeah.
There was a tab that was super popular every time I heard somebody mention it called the Great Suspender. I just tried to Google it and there was a bunch of articles about Google killing it because apparently maybe it had some malware in it or something. But the point of that tab was this feature. It was that it would a little bit more aggressively perhaps shut down tabs okay. that you weren't using on purpose to save memory. And I think people was rather beloved.
Yeah.
Because it was, you know, people like fast Chrome, you know, or fast any browser. So I don't know. To me, it seems good. I've seen this happen a million times and never once have I went back to a tab, saw it refresh and been somehow disappointed that it was doing that. Like never. So to me, it just seems like only a positive.
Yeah, no, I'm in the positive camp. I mean, it does have this weird like staleness, you know, but you know, it's also browsers are trying to do a lot. Like they're.
Does that mean it's not doing push notifications? I mean, how many websites are doing push notifications these days anyway?
Hopefully zero. But according to Mozilla, like 99% of websites or users say, no, don't send me. I think that's where service workers can come into play because that's a worker not on the main thread. You know, it's happening off screen, kind of in the background. And it's basically like, oh, if you get something for me, let me know, and then I can do something with it. So it's responds to inputs. So
cool.
I think they solved that problem. So you don't have to have the long pull asking for new notifications or something. So
we'll do one more and then we're going to call it.
Okay. That's fine by me.
Jackson Bates writes in, I work at a company with just two devs. On the non-tech side of the company, we have tons of feature requests and new ideas for areas we can grow in. So we bring in lots of outside agencies to help with data strategy, platform redesign, AWS infrastructure, shipping a WordPress marketing site or something, security, all that jazz. So a reoccurring pattern that we are seeing is that when it comes to delivery, the consultants fairly often aren't actually capable of delivering. For example, we hired this WordPress team and they didn't know how to deploy it. So they handed it over in pretty poor shape. Or the cloud experts didn't seem to actually, you know how to change DNS records to, you know, use that stuff. So inevitably I get pulled in to work on it and kind of clean up the mess. So Jackson's wondering, is there any reliable methods you can think of for assessing consultants' capabilities before getting in too deep? Or any other obvious tells we should be on the lookout for to spot the cowboys?
Well, I hope you're not talking about Paravel, but that's fine. I think price is probably part of it, you know?
Did you cheap out?
Did your company cheap out? Like, and so you may have to hire people who can do stuff. I mean, you can like, proven track records, you know, like do they appear to have shipped a bunch of products or projects? Maybe it's something weird about your setup that's different. Like, sure, they didn't deploy, but is it because you have weird like enterprise deployment requirements or something? You know, like that happens on our end sometimes. It's like it's like, cool. Hey, here's your website. It's ready to go. And they're like, oh, well, we can only deploy on Azure DevOps or something. And it's really locked down. You know, it's like, oh, that's a twist. Like, let's figure that out, you know, and maybe we'll need your help to like actually get that deployment. Cause we don't have your Azure account, you know? So that's something that happens in, so it could be on y'all's end is what I'm just.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, don't you, when you hire, don't you like set expectations? And then if they fail in those expectations, like there's something in the contract where they don't get paid or don't get paid as much or something. Like it seems like they failed at doing the thing that you hired them to do. Like how yeah. is that?
I mean, every contract, well, at least we try, you know, unless it's sort of like a let's just code and figure it out kind of thing. Most contracts have some kind of deliverable, or you narrow down what the deliverable is, you know? And maybe you just need to be like deployed website or try to come up. It's hard to come up with all these things overall, but maybe you just write a Notion doc or something of all these questions or problems you've had. And then next time you get a somebody, you just like go through it and just be like, okay, who does this? Who does the deployment? Who's, where does it live? Where does the project live? Who manages it? You know, how does it deploy? I feel like Brad Frost has that front end developer questionnaire. Is that what it's called? But it's basically like, you know, who's doing SaaS? Who manages that? Stuff like that. But you could build that for your consultants to figure like to like fill out like who handles deployment, you know, stuff like that. So
yeah, it's like, so it's kind of on both sides, but mostly yours to be more clear about all your requirements and ask ahead of time, you know, this is a requirement of this project. I'm not going to spring it on you at the end. This is what the end game is going to look like. That way nobody's assuming anything. Like they either can do it or they can't. And then if they say they can and can't, then it feels more like a breach of contract mm-hmm. rather than a just like, oh, I thought you could do this and you couldn't. Meh.
Yeah. Well, and then maybe you just say like, hopefully they know people, you know, like, do you know somebody who can do that or whatever? I too, this is me. Cause it's not me at the same time. Like we'll engage with people and there's like cocky developers and I mean that in the nicest way possible and more timid, like wishy-washy, and I'm probably on the wishy-washy end, like, oh, I don't know, it depends, you know, what, like what server, what, you know, CMS, you know. But then there's some people who are just like, oh yeah, what, you're doing this, sweet, we're gonna knock it out of the park, we'll have a website, boom, yeah, we're doing it, we're gonna, like they kind of operate on that like positive, less like questioning, self-deprecation side of things. I think like you can find those people, if you can find those people who are just like way too sure of themselves almost, you know, like I think those people are great because they actually do tend to deliver like a working product. Mm-hmm. So maybe cool. Do that. That's a good way to do it, you know? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems fair. I mean, I've had disappointing consultants too. I mean, I've worked with some that are really slow, for example. And then I was like, slow? That I didn't even set up a time frame in retrospect. So who's slow? You know, like that's that. I can't, absolutely cannot blame someone for that. It's just some feeling I have, even though I didn't communicate it or outline it while hiring them. That's on me, not them.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's some of it too, right? Like, and I say this as somebody who's hired as a consultant and somebody who hires consultants, it's sort of like, if you don't set the expectation, like you maybe, like maybe that's on you. So like, you know, like, are you doing daily standups with people to like figure out stuff, or like when, you know, what's your frequency of checking in and stuff like that? I know that's more work, but like, you can at least make sure like the project's on track or something. So there's always a million things, but like, I don't know. I think there's, this is the human part of web development, right? Where it's just like two humans colliding and that you have to talk through your expectations. And so,
yeah, fair enough. Well, thanks, Mr. Dave. Hey, we'll, yeah. We're going to keep trucking along on this JavaScript in 2021 thing with there's more to talk about than, I just feel like we'd talk about bundlers and ESM forever. And those are a big part of the story, but There's other things to talk about, and we have some guests lined up, so look forward to that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, dear listener, for downloading this in your podcast. Our favorite episode. People find out about the show. Follow us on Twitter at ShopTalkShow. Tens of tweets a month. And head over to patreon.com/ShopTalkShow and sign up and get in that Discord, baby. Let's do it. Having fun.
Let's do it.
Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
No, just to ShopTalkShow.com and click on the Patreon link. Bye.